Support for this show comes from Sylvan Learning. When children love learning, they can tackle any challenge life throws at them. Sylvan's Insight Assessment can help you determine if your child is ready for what's ahead. It can also identify gaps in learning and point out areas that could be of concern for your child so they can tackle what's to come. And right now, it's the best price of the year at $29. Go to sylvan29.com to learn more and get your child's assessment for only $29. That's sylvan29.com.
Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I'm Max Linsky, and I'm here with my co-hosts, Aaron Lammer and Evan Ratliff. Gentlemen, hello.
Hey.
Hey, guys.
You got a squeaky chair over there.
Real squeaky.
I don't think the microphone will pick it up.
We need some WD-40 in here.
Is this our last episode for the year?
No, we actually have two more.
Okay, never mind.
You're done, though. So, you know, you can just celebrate that if you want.
See you guys.
Yeah.
All right, without Evan, Max, who'd you talk to?
I talked to Jason Vigoni, and I was really excited to talk to Jason Vigoni. He writes for Wired, and he writes for Philadelphia Magazine. He just came out with this book called Ingenious, which I really liked. And he also, fun fact, wrote one of the first stories ever recommended on longform.org.
I love that story.
What story was that?
It was the GQ story.
Yeah,
GQ story about Marvin Harrison, ex-football player, possibly murderer.
Quite possibly murderer. That story is fucking nuts.
Jason Vigoni, I will just say to his credit, among many things to his credit, has been a longtime supporter of Longform, and we appreciate it. You can do the same kind of appreciating if you send a tweet out or rate us on iTunes.
You know what else you can do if you want to support this show?
What's that?
You can buy an Atavist story.
Yeah.
Yes, you can. Do we have a new one?
You can buy the latest Atavist story. You can buy it at atavist.com. It's by Brooke Jarvis, and it's called When We Are Called to Part. She once worked on the last leper colony in the United States in Molokai, and she goes back to see what's happening there now. It's a great story.
Our sponsor this week is Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. They do really good work there. I always notice sites that are Squarespace. Thank you, Squarespace. Also this week,
Tiny Letter. You guys, Tiny Letter.
Classic.
Simple, elegant way to send an email newsletter. It's done by the good people at MailChimp.
We have the best sponsors.
Yeah, so true. Hey, Jason Vigoni.
Hey, Max.
Thanks for coming, man. You came all the way up from Philly. I appreciate it.
Oh, yeah. I've been looking forward to it. Thank you.
Well, we have all kinds of great things to talk about, but we were just talking about a story you wrote for GQ in 2010. Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Called The Dirtiest Player, which is about Marvin Harrison. And that story is one of the inspirations for our website. It's one of the first stories we ever posted on Longform.
Seriously?
Yeah. And it was one of the stories that I was like, so many people didn't read this story. And it was one of the things I was like, we gotta find a place to just put all this stuff in one place. And that one in particular, actually, my friend Charlie, a friend of mine from high school or college, sent me that story and was like, I never read any of this shit, but this is amazing.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. I'm honored, man.
So part of the reason I was really excited to talk to you, because that story is fucking crazy.
Well, we're closing a loop.
Yes. Here it is, finally. It came out almost 4 years ago now.
Yeah. It was kind of, you know, I was going to say it was like one of those stories that fell through the cracks at the time in the papers.
Yeah.
You know,
Why don't you just give us a quick preamble about it, a synopsis?
Sure. So I read the story for the first time recently, for the first time in years. So I don't remember it quite as well as I used to. But the basic tale is that Marvin Harrison, 8-time Pro Bowl wide receiver with the Indianapolis Colts, is involved in a shooting in a rough part of Philadelphia, and he is kind of in a jam about it. Nobody really knows what happened. The cops have one story. Marvin Harrison and his lawyer have another story. A year later, one of the people who was a witness to the shooting is himself killed.
Yeah.
And these
so killed like 2 blocks from Marvin Harrison's car wash.
Yeah, a couple of blocks from the car wash and from the bar that he owned,
right.
Playmakers in Philly. So there are these kind of twin stories in the papers, and I remember having seen them and read them and thought, you know, that's kind of strange.
Yeah.
But I think this was a case, it wasn't so much that the story fell through the cracks because all of the pieces were out there laying around.
Right.
It was more that I think it took someone to kind of pick up the pieces and string them together into a narrative, you know, a story with a beginning, a middle, and an end.
Yeah. I mean, it's wild to me because you would think like, okay, so if there were two like quasi-related shootings in Philadelphia, you know, a year apart, I could see that being a story that kind of like slips through the cracks. But when they involve like a Hall of Fame football player, how is this not a huge story? That was the reaction. That was like that email that my friend sent me about the piece. And that was my reaction when I read it when it came out in 2010, was just like, how has this not been a huge story?
Yeah.
How, like, this guy was quite possibly, at the very least, involved in like a shootout and a murder.
Well, it was a big deal. It was, you know, it was in the Philly press for a while.
Yeah.
But I think the problem was that the DA didn't want to do anything with it. So the DA, Lynn Abraham, who had a reputation for, you know, being tough on punks. She called them punks. She was one of those, you know, she was, you know, elderly woman, gray hair, very hard,
yeah.
Very tough. And she held a press conference and said, we're not going to press charges because it's impossible to untangle the conflicting witness accounts in this case. And it became, I think, an instance then of journalism kind of doing better than what the DA could do.
Right.
Because her argument was essentially that the witness accounts were so tangled that you could never really find out the truth. But, you know, talking to some of the witnesses and talking to the police, it really was clear that, you know, there was a version of events that was basically a consensus version of events.
Right. There's a thing that... It is quite tangled, and the witnesses, including one of the guys who got shot, they are not like entirely reputable characters on their own.
Right.
Like they're you know, they have gotten into trouble themselves, and there's a point in that story where you kind of like turn to the reader almost, and you're like, just so we're clear, like these guys have their own rap sheets, and it's very like sort of plain, straight ahead storytelling. And it's interesting to hear you like point to that being the thing that the DA couldn't get around, that like there was all this muddledness. And I feel like you have a way in this story and in a bunch of other stories of kind of like just going right after the muddledness, like just trying to explain what's like weird or counterintuitive or tricky or whatever in sort of the plainest language that you can.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah. Is that an accurate
description? Yeah, no, my favorite part of the story is actually probably the graph that you're talking about where I basically say everybody's a piece of shit.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah.
Like everybody, and that's how the cops said it, you know. They said, look, everybody in this story is a piece of shit.
Right.
All the witnesses are a piece of shit. It's just that there is one person who is the least piece of shit.
Yeah, the least shitty.
The least piece of shit, and that was Robert Nixon. That was the guy who was one of the witnesses to the shooting and from whose perspective I tell the lead of the story. And they found him to be the least piece of shit, so he was the most credible guy, and he was the one who had a bullet in his back, allegedly from Marvin Harrison's gun.
Were you nervous going after Marvin Harrison, trying to tell this story about how he was maybe implicated in this thing? Was it like, how'd you go about it, I guess?
Yeah, so I basically got an email from an editor I trust at GQ, a really good guy named Brendan Vaughn, and he pointed me to one of the stories in the newspaper and said, hey, there may be something here.
Yeah, you were like the guy in Philly.
Yeah, I was the guy in Philly, right?
Right.
So he knew that I was the guy in Philly, and he's like, could you go check this out? And our idea was that we would give it 2 weeks. You know, we would report for 2 weeks and see what we came up with. And if there was a story that was reportable for GQ, we'd go forward. If there wasn't, we would just bag it. And I remember there was a point where I was in the Philadelphia Free Library, like, going through microfiche, which is so horrible. I was just in there for hours going through these old newspapers. I was trying to find some piece of evidence that would establish the provenance of Marvin Harrison's birth father.
Right.
There was this space around Marvin Harrison's birth father and all of the profiles that had been written about him in Sports Illustrated. He's a famous football player, so you can go back and you can read all of the clips. And you can read everything that's ever been written about him, and nobody ever talks about his birth father.
Mm-hmm.
It's always just about his mother. And you start to sense that there's this kind of space.
Yeah.
He also had an adult mentor who had kind of been protecting him, and there were a couple of comments about how this mentor had been protecting him from some elements in his past. So I was trying to track down who his birth father was. I eventually found a clip about his birth father's death, which I correlated with some court records. And that gave me the whole entree into Marvin Harrison's family history, which is right. this incredibly violent history. He had two brothers who were also...
half-brothers.
Half-brothers yeah. who were also violent criminals. One of them was allegedly an enforcer with the mafia, the Philadelphia mafia. And the other one had had been playing in a youth basketball game. He was subbed out. He was upset crazy. About it. And he rode off on a bike. He came back with a Tech Nine and started shooting. That's Marvin Harrison's family.
That's one way to handle getting taken out of a game.
Yeah, yeah.
What was the aftermath? Like, what happened after it came out?
So, there was quite a bit of attention, and I think there was a general feeling of surprise and shock that no charges had been brought against him. The DA, the new DA, Seth Williams, said that he was going to look into the charges again. And I waited for him to do that, and he never did. So essentially, there was a civil suit that had been filed by Robert Nixon, the guy who had been shot, and that civil suit settled. I think it settled with a confidentiality agreement. Mm-hmm. So we're probably never going to know.
Wow.
We're never going to know. He's going to be a first ballot NFL
yeah.
Hall of Famer, no question.
For sure. Yeah. And you never heard from him. You never saw him. You haven't seen him since.
No.
Wow. Wild. So, Jason, there's a couple of things I want to talk to you about now that we've talked about Marvin Harrison, which is the thing that I was really super excited to talk to you about. But there are a couple other things that I'm interested in talking about. And one is that you're writing for like a whole bunch of places at this point, and I'm interested in sort of how you're balancing that like kind of freelance life. A lot of the people we've talked to, especially lately, have been on staff somewhere, and it seems like you're kind of like doing your thing in a whole bunch of different places. And I'm also interested as part of that is sort of like the finances of how you do that and
sure.
how money works. And
how do you make
this.
A living?
Yeah.
Can you really make a living?
If you could just put everyone who's listening, if you could just put their mind at ease and tell everyone that it's totally fine and you could totally make a living.
Oh, it's so easy.
That'd be great.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah.
So I want to talk about that too, but I think we should talk about first... This month you just put out a book.
I did.
You are now a two-time book author.
Yes. Yes.
All right. Well, the book's called Ingenious.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you can give us like the brief description of the book.
Sure. It's about a bunch of people who are making things. It's about sort of a quest to make something that matters, something that's going to make a difference.
Well, they're all just making the same thing though, right?
They're making cars. It's about a $10 million competition to create the super efficient car of the future. Called the Automotive X Prize, and I was following a bunch of teams who were not huge automakers, but little guys with big ideas, essentially.
Yeah.
And I was with them in the build phase when they were making the cars, and then I was with them on the track when they were racing the cars against each other on a NASCAR track in Rural Michigan.
And it wasn't like born out of an article, right?
No. So it was born out of me living in Philadelphia. And reading a newspaper article about a bunch of high school kids who make super efficient hybrid cars. And I went over to see their garage. And their garage was like something straight out of the 50s, you know, all sorts of old machines and like old dusty racks of parts. But then they were making these original hybrid cars of totally unique design. I remember one of the cars when I went over there, the hybrid drive was up on a bench, and it looked like a piece of outsider art. It had it was built around a Harley Davidson V-twin engine and an electric motor. A Harley Davidson, as far as I can tell, has never been used as the internal combustion engine part of a hybrid. It was like, it was put into a Ford Focus. It was like the loudest Ford Focus in existence. It growled like a Harley.
Are you a car guy? You're talking like a car guy.
Yeah.
But are you only a car guy because of this book?
I'm not. I'm not at all. I'm a fraud.
you're doing a great car guy impression, but... If you weren't a car guy, what about that newspaper story drew you? Like, are you following up on like stories in the Daily all the time?
Yeah. I really am not a car guy. Like when I was reporting this book, I was driving a Honda Accord with 120,000 miles on it and a busted front fender. You know, and when I turn the key in the car, I just expect it to work. I don't have any patience for radical or crazy engineering. I just want it to work. But there was something about the state of America in 2010 that made this contest resonate with me. You know, it was a pretty rough time. Economic depression, the banks had been bailed out, General Motors and Chrysler had failed, And it just seemed like kind of all of the big guys in American, you know, society had let us down, all of the elites. And here was a contest that was explicitly looking to the little guy and saying, you know, we don't care what you've done before or how much money you have in your pocket. If you solve this problem, you win the money. And there was just something so optimistic and hopeful and cool about that to me.
Well, and the people who would sort of sacrifice in the way that the characters in your book sacrifice to try and get it to happen are also incredibly optimistic, hopeful people.
Yeah, well, they really had their backs against the wall in a dark economic time. You know, they were maxing out credit cards and, you know, putting their financial future at risk, putting even their marriages at risk. And they were doing it because they were trying to make something that was important, something that mattered.
So let's go back just to the sort of genesis of the thing, because I'm interested in that. I feel like it might be helpful for people as they're trying to decide, like,
sure,
is this going to be a magazine article? Is this going to be, you know, a Kindle single? Is this a book? You know, so you go and you follow up on that newspaper story, and when are you like, okay, this is something I'm going to spend 4 years of my life on?
So the full story is that I had sold a book that was a completely different book. this is like I guess the business side of it. But I had sold a book about a malaria vaccine. I was going to write about a group of scientists who are trying to make a malaria vaccine to save a million people a year. And I had negotiated access to this group of scientists, and then discussions kind of broke down about access, and access became harder and harder to get.
Oh, wow.
And so I had to back out of the project. So my publisher quite kindly gave me 4 months to find another idea instead of just pulling the whole thing. So I was really scrambling. I was looking for an idea. And
did you try out any others?
I did. I'm not going to tell you what they are because they were not promising.
Oh, you're not going to tell me because you're going to go do them, but because they
just weren't good ideas. So I found this team, and it kind of ended up opening up into this larger world, and it kept on getting bigger and bigger. It wasn't just this team of, you know, kids from Philadelphia who were making hybrid cars. There were hundreds of other teams that were trying to win this contest,
right.
And a couple of them were really fascinating. When it clicked for me actually is when I met this guy named Oliver Kuttner. Oliver Kuttner is this fiery German, very tall, kind of physically domineering. And I went to visit his shop in Lynchburg, Virginia. He had taken over a Dickies jeans factory and built a little car shop on the floor. And he asked me to hold on my hand, and he put a little piece of metal in my hand. And I looked down at my hand, and I'm holding a lug nut. And a lug nut is like the most humble part of a car. It's like it holds the wheel onto the car. And I look up at Oliver, and he's just grinning at me. He's like waiting for me to get it. And I didn't get it then. But I came to understand about Oliver is that the lug nut was a very light lug nut. It was a lug nut that was 3 to 10 times as light as a normal lug nut. And what he wanted me to understand was that he was so insane about saving weight on a car that he would even re-engineer the humble lug nut to do it. His idea for a car to win the X Prize was a car that was a very light car. He actually called it that, the very light car.
Mm-hmm.
It was so light you could push it across the floor with your thumb. And it was so light that it, you know, it could get incredible efficiencies even while using a very small internal combustion engine. Henry Ford once said, "The most beautiful things in the world are those from which all excess weight has been eliminated." And Oliver believed
that.
That's
a good editing tip.
Yeah, yeah. It's broadly applicable, I think. And Oliver promised to share his vision of the future with me in as much detail as I wanted to see it. And I think it's a vision of the future that makes sense. You know, he was trying to design a car for a warming world, a world where raw materials are scarcer and cost more money,
yeah,
and a world where people have less money to spend.
Hey, it's Max. I'm going to pause things for just a second and tell you a little bit about our sponsor. It's Squarespace. Squarespace is the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. We've told you about them before. Here's the thing with Squarespace, right? They've got a whole bunch of things that make them really nice. They've got 24/7 support. You can email them if you're having a problem. They'll help you out. They've got all of their design works on cell phones and tablets, any cell phone, any tablet, responsive design. You don't have to worry about that. They also just released a bunch of apps that make it really easy to manage your site from your phone or your iPad. You can upload stuff. You can check your stats. All super simple, super easy. But here's the thing. The real reason you want to use Squarespace is because you have to build a website. You got to do it for yourself. You got to do it for your business. You, I don't know, you're getting married or something. Squarespace will allow you to put up a really professional looking website really quickly. You don't have to know a lick of code. My dad could do this if he needed to. All you do, log on, pick a template, start moving things around, dragging and dropping, putting in your titles. All of a sudden, you got a website in no time, and it looks pro. Like, it looks like something a web developer would do, and it looks that way because they've got a bunch of really good designers, really good web developers who have done it for you. Another nice thing about Squarespace, it doesn't cost anything to try it. So go check it out, squarespace.com. If you do upgrade, and chances are you will because it is that easy, use the code LONGFORM12, you'll get 10% off. It's a pretty good deal, and it helps us too if you use the code. So go check it out. Use that code, LONGFORM12. And thanks very much to Squarespace for continuing to sponsor the show. Okay, back to Jason. And now, so you're finding these people who have this sort of wonderful, hopeful vision for where we can get with this stuff. How much did their chances factor into who you decided to really spend time with for the book? Because,
yeah.
Like, you just told me before that it took you 4 years. You were working on the book for 4 years. So it's like, if you're going to invest that much time, you really want someone who's like there at the end, maybe has a chance to win, right? You need that like climactic finish.
Yeah, that's a great question. That was the mercenary part of it, was trying to pick somebody who was going to win and last. So
you're also like a reporter, you're reporting on it, but you're also like betting on it.
Yeah, I was like handicapping it. Yeah. I'm like, I wanted to pick four teams, and I picked the West Philly kids because they were close to me, and also because they had actually beaten MIT in previous fuel efficiency competitions. So I felt like they had the track record, and they were going to make it pretty far. I picked Oliver Kuttner and Edison too, just because I thought Oliver was so insane that he would stop at nothing to win. He would literally spend all of his money down to nothing and imperil his entire life to win this contest. He was that consumed by it. So I'm like, I'm going to follow that guy and see what happens. And then I followed a team called Aptera Motors, a startup in California, because they had the most venture capital.
They're like the Yankees.
Of this contest, they were the Yankees. Compared to the big automakers, they're still, you know, tiny AAA team. But they had $24 million, which was way more than anybody else had. And the fourth team I picked because, honestly, I just thought they were a good human interest story. This was a guy, a 39-year-old dude in central Illinois, who set out to build an electric car in his barn by hand. Literally, he literally went to a scrapyard, got lengths of steel, melted them in a wood-burning stove, and bent the steel around plywood forms to make the arched rib of the car's skeleton. Then he welded them together by hand. You know, you see robots welding things in car commercials. This car was welded by one dude. I thought it was going to snap like, you know, one of the welds would snap like a chicken bone at, you know, 70 miles an hour. I thought he was crazy. But
yeah. Reading that part of the book, I was like even more embarrassed for how terrible I am at like putting up a shelf.
Yeah, they made the entire car by hand. I'm not a car guy. I didn't know you could make a car like this. They welded it together. Then they put parts that they salvaged from scrapyards.
And he does it with his wife.
He did it with his wife and with his father and brother and his friends. Initially on weekends, but eventually he was taking time off of work to work on the car. This is the kind of contest that just consumed people.
Yeah. I guess I'm interested in how you balanced this larger project. I mean, you know, over the last 4 years, you've turned out, I don't know how many dozens of magazine stories. How are you balancing this sort of like the book project with all the other stuff that you had to get done? Like, was that operating on the margins of the rest of your life, or was it the other way around?
So I think I was trying, there were some times when I was working intensely on the book and trying to fit magazine stuff around it. And then there were some times when I just had to work on magazine stories to make money.
Mm-hmm.
But the book was really the shining goal.
Right.
I mean, I tried to do my best with the magazine work. But a lot of the time it was tough. It was tough, but you can't work on a book all of the time. There are sort of intense periods and fallow periods. So,
mm-hmm.
So it was possible to mix.
Is it more stressful during the like intense periods or the like fallow periods?
Oh man, I get antsy when I don't have work, when I don't have something that's due.
Yeah,
I think it's just a natural result of having done this for, you know, a couple of years now. Is that when there's no deadline, I start to look for something.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, it's not, writing isn't like a zero sum thing. I mean, sometimes if you have multiple projects, you know, one can kind of heat up the other one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not that one is taking time away from the other one. It's that thinking about one can distract you in a interesting or useful way.
Right. You get some momentum going on one and it starts feeding into the other.
Yeah.
How many projects are you working on at once?
I write about pot now.
You're on the pot beat?
I'm on the pot beat.
The pot beat, I got to tell you, man, the pot beat is such a good beat. Someone is going to do the great, someone's going to do The Verge for weed. And it's going to be such a good website.
Yeah, and it'll be a monster too.
Yeah, it's going to kill it. Someone's going to do it. I'm sad that I'm not going to do it. I should really.
You could do it. I should just quit.
Yeah, I think I'd have to quit everything to do the weed site. Well, you really have to quit everything.
Yeah,
but someone should do the weed site.
You know, it would be a good business. I mean, the weed people.
The advertising for the weed site is about to go completely insane.
Oh,
you could do product reviews. You know?
Yeah.
And then you do some news stuff and some feature stuff. You can do video.
No, High Times is adding pages, you know, in an environment where a lot of magazines are cutting them. I just wrote a piece for the New Republic about how High Times is the most influential magazine of our time.
That's such a slaty headline.
Yeah. It was a very slate pitch article. But yeah, I mean, the pot people, I wrote a pot story for Grantland. And again, I don't know a ton about pot. I wrote it a lot so I could teach myself about it.
Well, let's talk about that story because that's also on my list. It's called The Willy Wonka of Pot, and it's got about this guy named DJ Short. And DJ Short is one of the great cannabis growers of our time.
Yeah,
if there was a weed Hall of Fame, he'd be in the weed Hall.
Well, he is in the ganja Hall of Fame. He's in the High Times Seed Bank Hall of Fame.
Oh, right,
the Seed Bank Hall of Fame. For his arsenal of great ganja genetics was there for us.
He actually is in the Hall of Fame. Yeah, so you went out and found this guy. No one had ever profiled him before.
No, he's a mysterious figure, a long sort of semi-anonymous figure. Nobody had known where he lived, what he did, what he cared about, where his ideas came from. He had published a short book in 2003 called Cultivating Exceptional Cannabis, an expert breeder shares his secrets. But it wasn't, you know, highly in high circulation or anything. It's not a super well-known book.
Although it is, in your words in that story, it is excruciatingly well-written.
It's irritatingly well-written. Yeah, it is. He's a writer. I mean, that's really what drew me into DJ Short is I recognized in him kind of a kindred, you know, I think a kindred spirit. And talking to him, I mean, he's incredibly well-read, incredibly literate. I mean, he was talking about Pynchon and Jonathan Swift and stuff, and he's like this aging hippie guy.
Yeah.
And he had also written a 200,000 word memoir of his time fighting fires in Oregon on a woodland firefighting crew, and it was called Zero Fire, and it was like he had executed this 200,000 word memoir, and I was just in awe of that, you know. So I hung out with DJ Short. I think I got lucky in the sense that I sense that he might be a good character, a good way to explain how, you know, where the pot world is right now and sort of perched on the edge of legitimacy.
Yeah, it was funny. There's this great moment in that story where you quote directly from a cease and desist letter that he put out.
Yeah.
You are illegally stealing my illegal goods.
Right.
Yeah. I cannot enforce this at all, but maybe I will be able to soon. That's the end of the cease and desist is at some point in the near future, I think I will be able to punish you for this.
Exactly. He's laying down his marker.
It's right on the verge. It's right there where it's about to.
And it's Willy Wonka too was very interested in legalese, if you remember. Right. He had the long legal scroll, you know, trying to protect his ideas.
So you're really on the weed beat?
No. But there was definitely a moment where I was like, you know, this represents a possible future for me or a timeline. You know, I could just be the guy who writes about weed now and smokes weed and
a lot of weed?
Maybe I could be happy now. You know, maybe this is how I'll be happy. I'll just write about weed and smoke weed and be happy. And that would represent actually some sort of renegade.
Sounds like fun,
stance.
Man.
I know it sounds like I don't smoke weed actually, but
well, I was interested in that. I was trying to figure out for the first two thirds of that story whether you smoked a ton of weed or not, and then there's a moment in the story where you're like, and then he and I smoked weed.
Yeah, well, I did it for the story. I took a hit with him from a bowl, but you know, I've smoked weed a handful of times in my life, I would say.
Yeah.
But you know, it's not like I don't have any weed at home right now.
Yeah,
you know?
I smoked a lot of weed when I was a young man, and now I can't do it. I get too anxious. But I think that that's another sign that you should be on the weed beat. I think the great weed reporter is not going to smoke weed. That's
yeah.
My theory.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think you're right because you have to come to it with some sense of distance and abstraction. You know, the same way Jean-Marie Laskis writes about football, you know?
Yeah.
From sort of, there's like a naive standpoint.
You know who'd be a great weed reporter? Jean-Marie Laskis.
Yes.
She would be amazing. Jean-Marie, if you're listening, go...
We'll get her on it.
Go get on this weed beat, because Jason won't do it for some reason. So, all right, right now you are a contributing editor at Wired.
Right.
You are... Do you have a title at Philly Mag?
Writer at large.
You're a writer at large. That's such a good title.
I know.
Writer
at large.
I was an editor at large once, and it was really fun.
Sweet.
I really like telling people I was something at large. Okay, so you're a writer at large from Philly Mag. Does that mean they give you a check every month, or just when you write stories?
Yeah, I have it arranged so that they give me a stipend every month. I agree in the beginning of the year to write a certain number of stories for them, a certain right. amount of words, and I have it arranged as a stipend so that I have some level of predictability, and it replicates kind of the predictability of a salary. Because the thing about freelancing is, you know, I make more than I made on staff when I was on staff at magazines, but the money is more unpredictable.
Right.
It comes at times where it's hard to figure out, you know, it's hard to plan sometimes.
And being a contributing editor at Wired, do you get paid every month?
I do, yeah.
Well, that's nice. So you're getting checks from two places.
Yes. I mean, I do the work. I do the work. It's not, the whole thing, it seems, it's perched right on the edge of sustainability, you know. It's you know, and I have some book income, uh-huh. not much, but so, I mean, I definitely do fantasize sometimes about having like having a real job and a salary and stuff, and you know, taxes vex me. You know,
yeah,
I'm organized as a corporation so that I can protect myself in case someone were to sue me. But that means that my taxes aren't withheld. You know, I have to.
How often do you do stories because you know an editor will take them? And how often do you do stories because they're like the story you really want to do?
The Marvin Harrison story wasn't a story that I was like that into originally.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a mercenary thing. I thought, you know, I live in Philly. I should look into this.
Yeah. And,
but I actually kind of like doing it that way. I like not caring about the story at first and then finding a way to care about it.
Oh, that's interesting. It helps like guide your reporting and storytelling and such.
It helps me. There's usually a moment where I click into it, where I'm like, okay, now I feel like I know something that somebody else doesn't know, or now I feel like I can tell a story in a different way, and then I become interested in it, and then my passion is generating the forward momentum instead of, you know, in editors, and I like coming to stories like that for some reason. I'm not really sure why.
Is there a particular kind of story that you're drawn to? Is there a type of story you like to tell?
You know, my wife, I was getting ready to give a talk about my book, and I was practicing it with my wife, and she said, you know, you should start out by saying, these people in the book are all little guys with big ideas. And she said, that's what you write about most of the time, right? And I said, you know, that's exactly it. You know, like my life made sense to me in that moment, you know, in a way that it hadn't. But I think that's what I like. I like little guys with big ideas.
Why are you drawn to little guys with big ideas? Are you a little guy with big ideas?
I don't know. It could be. It could be. I mean, I write about a lot of strivers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my sister is a striver. She's 2 years younger than me. She's a professional ballet dancer with the Richmond Ballet.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah, she's like a professional ballerina. And she's like way more intense than me. I'm pretty intense. She's ridiculously intense. I mean, growing up with her, you know, I would be watching cartoons after school and like eating cereal, and she would be doing Pilates stretches, you know, for hours and hours. I mean, just her foot. I mean, if you look at her foot, it's disgusting. I mean, her foot is like, it's like a weapon of war. I mean,
that's like actually like becoming like the center fielder for the Boston Red Sox, becoming a professional ballerina.
Yeah.
That's like
she made it.
Totally.
And, you know, she's in the top 1%.
Wow.
And the thing about this business is that, you know, all the, you can, all the rewards are in the top, you know, 1%. So you have to try to get there. If you think that you can't get there, you know, it's tough.
You're talking about being a writer now?
I think being a writer. I think increasingly the rewards are all at the top. But, you know, or at least doing it, at least being a freelancer.
Yeah.
You know.
What do you actually mean when you say the top? Are you talking just about, like, pay? Or do you think that the people who are getting paid like that are the best?
Yeah, I do. I mean, I just published a book. I'm a guy who just published. I'm a couple weeks out from publishing a book.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting time in a writer's life.
How often are you looking at that Amazon page a day?
Oh, man. I told myself I wasn't going to look at it, and I broke that promise on day three.
Oh, wow. You stayed 3 days. That's pretty impressive.
I was pretty proud of myself, actually. And, yeah. and I've gone a couple of days since without looking at it. But, you know, it's the first couple of days are very exciting. You know, everybody, all your friends are coming through for you. They're tweeting about it and helping you. And there's this kind of rush of social media excitement. And, you know, the first reviews come out and they're good. And your editors are emailing you the reviews and everybody is really happy. And then there are a couple of days, like day five, day six, where it's kind of died down. Nothing is really happening, and you're just sitting there waiting for something to happen. You're like, something, please happen. And,
right.
And there was a pretty dark day where I was looking at my Amazon ranking and it was just plummeting. And the thing about this is that, you know, it's not a secret to anybody how well my book is selling. You can just go to Amazon and look.
We'll
at the
put
ranking.
It in the show notes.
Yeah. Right. Thanks. So I was going to Amazon and looking at the ranking. I was just like, I just felt like I was looking at some of the other books that were selling, and I just felt like I was, you know, in this vast stadium and raising my hand. And I was being like, hey, I'm Jason. I published this book. You know, it's about cars and inventors, and I think you'll like it. And somebody was like, hey, quiet down. You know, we want to hear about the fucking Duck Dynasty guy. You know, like we want to hear from Cy, the Duck Dynasty uncle. You know, or like we want to hear from Doris Kearns Goodwin, who wrote, you know, a book about Teddy Roosevelt. You know, the 500th book about Teddy Roosevelt. I don't think people are even reading that book. I think they buy it as gifts. You know,
right.
like how can I get somebody to buy my book as a gift that they won't even read? I mean, that's some kind of crazy mojo that I don't quite understand. And then there was like a day where I was like, or a morning where I was like incensed at Chris Hadfield, the astronaut, which just shows you how deranged you can get. Because Chris Hadfield is like one of the greatest human beings alive, right? I mean, Chris Hadfield, he goes to the International Space Station and he's like taking pictures of the Earth, and he's writing these incredibly poetic things about them, and he's sharing the majesty and wonder of space with a new generation in this incredibly generous way. And you know,
like, fuck that guy.
Yeah, I was like, and he's like, singing a David Bowie song in zero gravity and doing all these science experiments, and I'm like, dude, I can't do any of that. I can't be an astronaut. You know, I can't grow like a full bushy mustache, manly mustache like you have. I can't sing like you can. The book thing is my thing. This is what I can do, and you're even beating me at that. Yeah, you know? But then you realize that, you know, you really are lucky to be able to do this, and, you know, not a lot of people get to do it, and good things. And then a couple of good things happen and it pulls you out of it, and you realize, you know, this is a cool life. This is a cool way to make a living.
How often do you go through that roller coaster? is that like a weekly occurrence?
It recurs a little bit. I mean, it is hard to feel like, you're just kind of like out there naked in being valued by the market,
right?
In a way that you usually aren't when you're writing for magazines, right? When you're writing for a magazine, the magazine is doing all the selling and the advertising, and you don't have to.
If it doesn't go well, you can blame the magazine.
If it doesn't go well, it's not your fault. You know, you're not the face of it. You're not the vessel. Here, you're the face of it, you're the vessel, and so it feels very, it is kind of a vulnerable feeling being out there just having this value placed on you, and so it does recur from time to time, but, you know, I'm happy with the book. I think it represents the best of what I can do. I think it's really good. I'm proud of it.
That's good, man. You should be proud of it.
You know, I'm happy to have it out in the world. I'm happy to give it to anybody and say, here's my work, you know, and I think it... I think it will appeal to people who make things or want to make things, or anybody who really has a dream of, you know, leaving a better mark on the world. Or at least I hope it will.
Yeah.
I'm kind of inherently a pessimist, but so the book brought me out of that.
Well, this is the thing that I'm interested in about you, man, because these stories, I read back all the stuff, like, you write about this stuff that's dreamers, optimism, hope, people who want to do huge things. And it is really optimistic, it's hopeful work right. that you do. But I have been following you on Twitter for like 3 years or 4 years or something.
Right. And you see the bile and the darkness.
The darkness, man. Like the juxtaposition between you as an author and you as a tweeter is wild. It's huge.
Yeah.
That's funny. Which is the real Jason?
You know, I think part of me became a journalist so that I would become less shy. It brought me out of a shell. You know, I wasn't able to, before I became a journalist, I wasn't able to call somebody I didn't know on the phone and talk to them.
Yeah.
You know, I worked in a newsroom, and it just kind of beat that out of me.
Where were you working in a newsroom?
In the Daily Collegian at Penn State.
Right on. Yeah.
And before that, I mean, I stumbled into it by accident, really. My high school paper, I was... I worked on the paper, but I wasn't really that into it. And then I ate lunch with these guys at a table who were just assholes. And one of them would, every day he would go.
Where'd you grow up?
In Chester County, Pennsylvania, like horse country. And he would go to the lunch line, get tater tots, bring them back to the table, put a bunch of tater tots in his mouth, take the mashed tater tots out of his mouth, form them into a ball, and throw them against the wall. And the tater tots just stuck against the wall. And halfway through the year, there was just like this brown plaque. They never cleaned it. And I was just so disgusted by it. But
these were the guys you sat with at lunch?
These are the guys I sat with at lunch. And but the school newspaper had its own little room up on the second floor, like a little supply closet. And if you worked on the paper and you were really into it, you could eat lunch up there. So I exited the lunchroom. I started eating lunch up in the supply closet of the newspaper, and hanging out with those people. And that's how I got really into the paper. You know,
didn't occur to you like go sit and eat lunch with somebody else, not like the tater tot asshole.
You're so stupid when you're in high school. You don't understand all of the opportunities that are available to you. You know, it just doesn't occur to you.
That's a good origin story. That's a weird. So you went from there, and then you went and you wrote for your college paper at Penn State.
Yeah, I probably spent a lot more time at my college paper than I spent at classes in some semesters.
So when you left school, that you were like, this is what I want to be doing?
Yeah, I took a class in long form journalism from a guy who is actually now reading my book and sending me Facebook messages about errors in it, like small errors in it.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah. Oh, it's great. It's awesome. But he was really influential. He introduced me for the first time to Tom Wolfe and Hunter Thompson and a lot of those kind of long form heroes, I guess.
Yeah.
And I got out of school just wanting to write long, and I think I had some friends who were trying to get internships at Time and Newsweek and stuff, so they could write. And they would be writing front of the book items and stuff and at a more prestigious place. And I chose instead to try to write long at a less prestigious place. So I moved to Cincinnati, Ohio, not knowing anyone there. And I worked for a Cincinnati magazine, a city magazine. I had an amazing editor and mentor there, Kitty Morgan. And I loved the job.
Did you move for the job?
I moved for the job, yeah. I couldn't meet women there at all. I mean, there was no... This was before Facebook. It was before any sort of social network. It was just that all of the Cincinnati social networks were locked down. All those people already knew each other. And I couldn't meet anybody. So my personal life was totally miserable, but it was an
Maybe
amazing
made,
job.
Might have made your work better?
I think so. I think it did, yeah, because I spent a lot of time there.
I had an experience like that in Tampa where I didn't really have any friends, and I was working on a newspaper and writing long stories. And my work was definitely better because I was so like lonely and pathetic in the rest of my life.
Yeah, there's something to it.
And so where'd you go from Cincinnati?
I got a job in Philadelphia, and I kind of came home to some extent. And I was hired by Larry Platt at Philadelphia Magazine. I was a staff writer from 2003 to 2005 with a lot of amazing people who you would know, Sasha Eisenberg, Ben J. Wallace, Vicky Glumbacki, Bob Huber, who else was there? Chris McDougall.
Yeah.
Who wrote Born to Run.
Sure. And this has like come up again and again in these conversations, is that first job you had where you were able to go to a smaller place and sort of like work out the kinks and get some chops.
Yeah.
what would be your advice for yourself then? Like, if a young writer at Penn State came up to you and said, I'm spending all my time working on the newspaper, I'm not going to class, this is what I want to do, I want to write long stuff, what would you tell them to do?
I would probably tell them to find a city magazine, try to find an in at a city magazine. I mean,
do you think those jobs still exist?
I think so. I mean, city and regional magazines are kind of considered, you know, a stepchild to some extent of the big national glossies, but I think a lot of them do really amazing work. And you know, it was a great place for me. I mean, I had my you know, I tacked my Tom Juneau stories up to the cork board. You know, I cut out my little picture of Christopher Hitchens in the trench coat, the green trench coat from the Vanity Fair, like looking to the side, you know, and kind of looking over his shoulder, and the picture of Joan Didion, you know, smoking the cigarette. It was like on my door. I must have been so fucking obnoxious to everybody else there. I can't even believe they tolerated me. But yeah, it was a great time.
So let's get back to the two Jasons then, right?
Yeah.
So you're like, you're writing this stuff that's just super optimistic, but then you're tweeting all the time, and you are a prolific tweeter. And a lot of it's pretty dark.
what's dark? What do you remember that's dark?
Well, I mean, I could call up your Twitter right now, but like I was in the last 2 days.
Yeah.
You've gotten quite mad at the... that Pando Daily partnership with Not Safe for Work.
Yeah.
NSFW. You're supposed to say NSFW.
NSFW, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah, you were not happy about that.
The last couple of days, I guess, have been like a reversion that we were talking about into kind of a more pessimistic outlook on stuff, I guess.
And then today, GQ, Devin Friedman wrote a piece about Charlie LaDuff, and you just blew it up.
Yeah.
You're so mad about it.
Yeah, I was really mad. Really mad. Momentarily. Yeah, I was, because I don't know. I just sometimes I feel like I have kind of like a hater mentality sometimes, and I don't know where it comes from, but it's like really, really powerful.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why I try to find some of these optimistic subject matter to bring me out of it.
Well, we don't need to spend a lot of time talking about LaDuff, but I'm interested in that instinct to be like, I want to talk about how I don't like LaDuff.
Yeah.
You know, because like my instinct in that situation is just to like lean across the table and tell Aaron like, fucking LaDuff.
Right.
But not to broadcast it.
Right.
You know, and I guess I'm interested in where that comes from.
Yeah, I don't know.
Does it work out for you? You know what I mean? I don't know.
Do people just think I'm an asshole?
Yeah, that's kind of what I'm asking. Like you're a wonderfully nice guy. Talking to you has been really fun. I'm really glad we did this. On Twitter, occasionally you're just like a fucking asshole.
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know, man. I don't know. I don't know. Don't you ever get angry about something that is important to you and want to communicate it and share your feelings with other people? I mean, or are you just afraid of repercussions?
I'm probably pretty afraid of repercussions. I'm not particularly conflict averse. I guess I just like, yeah, I don't know. That's not my instinct, but it seems like it works. Like it seems maybe you get to a good place. Like maybe you're going to end up talking to Charlie LaDuff.
I've probably got it coming. I'm going to publish something and somebody that I've pissed off is going to like rip me, and I'll deserve it, you know.
Will you be able to brush it off? I guess that's the thing. Like if you put up a story and people are like, God damn it, that fucking guy. Every time with that guy.
Yeah.
Like, will you be able to brush that off? Or when you're sitting in your home office and that like comes across?
No, I'll probably be stewing, you know, or I would want to respond to it. I mean, that's a good question. It's not something I've obviously thought about really that deeply.
sorry if we're going to a unnecessarily over analytical place.
No, it's, I don't know. I think I share a lot of stuff on Twitter that I love and like, and, you know, I feel like I share a lot of praise.
Has it made your writing better?
Yes. I feel like just having the compulsion is useful somehow. And I'm not exactly sure how.
Interesting. I have a couple more questions, then I'll let you go.
Sure.
One question is, you've sort of always written about the media. and it's been a sort of like side beat for you, I feel like. Like the, you wrote about the alt weeklies in Philly at some point, and you just wrote that piece about High Times. Like mm-hmm. you're interested in the industry, not just working in the industry. Like, do you have fantasies of being like a media reporter full time? Do you want to be like doing David Carr's column at some point?
No. I guess I had a couple of media studies professors at Penn State that were, I guess, influential and kind of got me attuned to media writing. I read James Fallows' Breaking the News in college, which was a huge influence and got me caring about how media is presented and I guess made me believe that media criticism could be useful and important. I mean, I guess I'm less interested in it now. I mean, I just want to tell stories and tell good stories and find good stories and talk less about how they come together, I guess.
Are you optimistic? Are you pessimistic about the state of this stuff? Like how do you feel about where long form journalism is at the moment?
Yeah, I feel hugely optimistic about it, actually. I tell people I get letters from younger writers sometimes asking for advice, and I tell them that as long as they have a pitch, then they can get a story anywhere. I really feel that's true. I mean, don't you feel that's true?
I think it's a meritocracy in a way that it hasn't been before.
Yeah.
I mean, it's still, the game is totally rigged, but I do think that if you like write something great, it'll probably get read.
Yes.
And that probably wasn't true before.
And that's been my experience with books too. I really feel like people at publishing houses are looking for new voices and are very open to pitches from young writers that work, that are good, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, most of the time that I hear from editors at bigger magazines, that's like the real question. That's like the thing that maybe I could be helpful with is like, who's a young writer that I haven't read yet? They're actively looking for those people, I think.
Yeah.
Maybe they always have been, but maybe it's just easier for them to get found now, I guess.
I think, I think with long form, actually, not to suck up to you, but I think long form has actually changed the economics of it. Long form and long reads have made it possible for a story that isn't necessarily in the most prestigious magazine to get the kind of circulation that a prestigious magazine would have gotten before.
That's nice to hear.
I mean, I think that it really has leveled the playing field and made it more democratic in that sense. Because I mean, to me, what matters when I think about a story now is who is going to allow me to write the best version of this. Where am I going to get the best editing? How can I make this story the best version of it that it can be? You know, I'm probably thinking less about where it's going to run, because all that matters now is whether it gets sucked up into the long form funnel. You know, and when it gets sucked up into the long form funnel, that's how it goes to heaven. You know, that's true. That's the truth. That it really has changed the way I think about things.
All right. Well, now I feel more pressure. You were saying earlier that like this stuff only really starts paying off when you're in like the top 1% of doing it.
Yeah.
Who are you thinking of? Like whose career do you want to emulate? What kind of stories do you want to be doing, you know, 10 years from now?
Oh, I don't know. It's so hard to see that far ahead, Max. It's, because it really is so precarious. my wife, works in tech, and she's great and hugely supportive. So, we have healthcare through her and everything. Without that, I don't think I would be able to do it. But even with that, it's a month to month or a definitely a year to year thing. So I really, honestly, I have no idea. I just want to keep on doing it. I've always thought, you know, I'll keep on, like my sister, who has continued to keep on doing it until she can't anymore. A dancer reaches a time when her body just breaks down, right? And my sister is close to that point. There aren't any 40-year-old dancers. You know, she's 33. So I've always kind of imagined that trajectory for myself. There will be a point when maybe I can't do this anymore, but until then I'm going to, you know, do it with all of my heart.
Seems like a good place to end. Jason, thanks for coming all the way up, man. This was really fun.
Oh, thank you, Max. I really enjoyed it.
Thanks for listening to Longform. I'm Max Linsky. My co-hosts are Evan Ratliff and Aaron Lemmer. Our fantastic editor is Lauren Kirchner. Our intern this week, Gavin Jenkins.
Thanks so much to Jason Fagoni for taking the time. Repay him. Go get that book, Ingenious. It will restore your faith in America, or at least restore your faith in a handful of people in America. Also, while you're out purchasing things to read, check out the new Atavist story. It's called When We Are Called to Part. It's by Brooke Jarvis. It too is great. See you next week.
Run. Why does anyone?
I always thought that runners loved running, and that's not the case. Most runners hate running, but they choose to do it.
In the new docuseries, Running Sucks, brought to you by Team Milk, Abby Ayers learns why women runners everywhere are driven to go the distance.
It really is about taking my power back and proving myself wrong.
Team Milk is about fueling women's performance and helping them along their marathon journeys. You can sign up now for the inaugural Every Woman's Marathon taking place in Savannah, Georgia on November 16th, 2024. Learn more and register at everywomansmarathon.com.